Marcus Brady Bowman with you on this Wednesday morning. It's already Wednesday. It's been a bit of a long weekend. 9:22 in the morning here in the Little Apple, here with Assistant Professor of Political Science at K-State, Dr. Nate Burkhead. Any questions, comments, concerns? We've got a lot of phone calls in our opening segment. That's 785-537-1350 is the number to call there. And Nate, we were talking a lot in that first segment about, we had a caller talk about spending. We had a caller ask about marijuana, taxing marijuana in the state and making steps to possibly legalize it to help our funding situation. We were talking over break about, you were talking about issues at K-State where cutbacks there, tuition has to go up. And I think we see the same thing at the city and county level when it comes to property taxes. And we talked about it a lot here where the state has really pulled back over past 10, 20 years a lot of the funding that they would give to the states to help help with property taxes, to help with all sorts of things. Those things have been pulled back. Shocker, the states and city or the counties and cities have to make up the difference.
Yeah, that's right. So, we kind of you can see two layers of this, right? One layer is from the federal level to the state level, where the federal government has been giving less and less money to the states over time, and that's making the states have to do more with less, so to speak. And then the states, then, as a way of compensating for that, are then doing less and less for the localities. So, as you say, counties and cities and the rest. Nonetheless, counties and cities have really important services that they provide, right? Everything from just making sure that the roads don't have potholes, that means that, you know, fewer people have to go get alignment checks and that sort of thing, to funding the schools. The way that they can make up that money that they're not getting from the state anymore is to tax property. And so, yeah, the property taxes, and we're seeing property tax increases. You see mill levies, and you know those are passing. I've got a couple of kids in public schools now, right? And so I'm grateful for that. I want their teachers to be well equipped. I don't like their teachers to be stressed out having, six or seven more kids in a classroom than they can handle. God bless the elementary school teachers handling like 18 6-year-olds. God bless them. Couldn't do it.
I could not do it at all. My mom's actually she just retired this year. Last week, I guess, was her last week with the school district in Winfield from where I'm from. She was a teacher's aide for a long time, and then she actually didn't get her contract extended a couple years ago, and it was right during some big cutbacks with public schools, and she wasn't renewed, but she did find work as a para within the school district, so she was able to keep going on capers and stuff like that. But she tells me some of the horror stories of some of the things that she's had to deal with, some of those middle school kids and elementary school kids, and not an easy job.
Not an easy job. So yeah, so property taxes, the money that the property taxes are generating are for things that people want, right? People want good education for their kids, they want good roads to drive on, and that's what those property taxes are going for.
And demand transfers, that's kind of the word I was looking for. Or the label on that from the state to the county. I know Commissioner Ron Wells has been very vocal about that. Yep. When you look at just million, it might be towards the $1 billion number now. If you look back the 10, 20 years of what counties and cities would normally get, imagine how much lower the mill levy would be if you had throw those in. And going back to that question on marijuana legalization. I was just throwing this out there, but 29 states in the country now have medicinal, and that's pretty mind-blowing in a lot of ways when you think about it compared to, say, 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's sort of, well, the whole medical marijuana and then also recreational marijuana now as well is a really bizarre turn of events, right? Is that, at the federal level, statute is pretty unequivocal, right? And so what we're seeing is our states are actually just flouting sort of federal law in the way that they're doing it. And so what's interesting is that these are typically, not exclusively, but typically liberal states who are using the same language about states' rights that you heard southern states use when they were flouting sort of national law on civil rights. And so, you know, southern states were, you know, continuing with segregation and Jim Crow practices and the rest, and saying, oh, national government, get off our backs, states' rights. And now we're finding the liberal states using that same terminology to sort of pass recreational marijuana or medical marijuana, again saying, hey, states' rights. And so it's an interesting turn in sort of the way that different camps are using the same sort of terminology, but for very different ends. But nonetheless, but the point that you're making is an important one, is that there's a lot of states right now that are moving in that direction. You know, particularly you look at like the opioid addictions that we're seeing in Ohio and all those fatalities there. A lot of public health researchers are kind of pointing to like alternatives to try to do whatever they can to kind of prevent all those needless deaths. But nonetheless, I think what the important thing to note there is just the state culture is that, you know, in the state of Kansas, it's a relatively conservative state. And it has been for some time. You know, it's difficult to get beer after 7 o'clock on Sunday nights. Right.
Yeah. And so
if that's a concern, right, if it was really contentious just to get alcohol being sold in grocery stores, then you can imagine the coalitions, the sort of the battle lines being drawn to prevent any sort of recreational marijuana from being sold.
And it's been surprising. I remember, I'm trying to remember, I'd probably have to look it up real quick, when same-sex marriage was legalized across the country. I think that was 2014, 15, something
so,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 2014. So right. Yeah, that was the Obergefell versus Hodges. Yep.
And when that happened, or actually leading up to that, before that happened, I always thought that at a national level, at a federal level, I always thought marijuana legalization would be before same-sex marriage just because of the dollar signs. That's the only reason I was thinking that was going to be first. So I was really surprised, actually, when same-sex marriage happened before marijuana legalization.
Yeah, the difference lies in as you say, it's a revenue stream.
Right.
But people don't get too enthusiastic about revenue streams relative to civil rights. And that's, you know, that's how the Supreme Court has interpreted same-sex marriage as a civil rights issue. And that's, you know, once you frame it in that language, right, it's, you know, okay, how can you stand against civil rights? And so then that was the shift from enforcing a particular morality view to enforcing a different morality view. That's, you know, that draws a lot more heat, but that also sort of once you change that language, it's a lot more important than just sort of the way you define this drug versus that drug. So we were talking a little bit before about sort of some stuff at the national level as well.
Right.
So I sort of wonder if you sort of wanted to.
Yeah, we can make that shift.
Cool. So you know, one of the things that something that caught my eye today is that there's a new study that came out by the Kaiser Permanente, an insurance company, and health group that noted that we're now seeing that more people support the Affordable Care Act as it is written than the House's Affordable Care Act repeal bill, the AHCA, which is really going to make an interesting turn as we go forward. I think that the Senate right now is currently writing a piece of legislation after finding out that the House piece of legislation that was passed just recently was just
that CBO score
the
came
CBO
out
score
last
came
week.
Out and just yeah. Yeah, just and just which of course so let's actually should we back up for a second and talk about what the CBO is?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so the CBO is called the Congressional Budget Office. It was created by Congress to help make Congress more powerful, right? And when you think about Washington D.C., you can either have the president be more powerful, or you can have the Congress be more powerful. And the president had previously been given the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, and that gave him a set of, you know, sort of nonpartisan bean counters, so to speak. Apologies to the accountants out there.
785-537-1350.
Number to call. He had a whole group of people who he had at his disposal, but Congress didn't have one. So Congress passed the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, to give them their own counterbalance, right, to sort of balance out the congressional power with the presidential power.
And just to back up, when did the CBO first come out?
1974. Okay. And so, and the CBO gives Congress a separate balance of separate source of power, right, to determine how effective these policies are, how much these policies are going to cost as they're negotiating with the president on budgets. That's the whole goal there. It's important to underscore that the Congressional Budget Office doesn't work for any party. The Congressional Budget Office works for Congress, and they are just nonpartisan, just kind of, just again, bean counters, right? They are their job is to get it right. Their job is not to make it look good for this group or that group. Their job is just to get it right.
Just looking at what they have in front of them.
Yeah, basically. Exactly. Looking at what they have in front of them. And so the CBO is a really powerful tool, particularly when Congress and the president are loggerheads. Then the Congress has their own estimates that they can use in negotiating with the president. If you get rid of the CBO, like what Newt Gingrich has recommended, then Congress actually becomes less powerful. Which is odd because, again, Newt Gingrich used to be the Speaker of the House, and so you would think that he would want Congress to be as powerful as possible, but it turns out that that was sort of that's inconsistent there. So anyway, so the CBO is this group of analysts, right, nonpartisan analysts, experts, who said that, you know, the American Health Care Act, AHCA, that the Republicans passed in the House is likely to leave, you know, a whole bunch of people 23 million out of health insurance. And then also it will cut the budget the budget deficit a decent bit. But that's, unfortunately for the proponents of the repeal, it's been pretty unpopular. And so this poll that I just saw today shows that, you know, the vast majority of people prefer the current Affordable Care Act to the American Health Care Act. So the people prefer what we have now, so-called Obamacare, to the House's plan for Trump Care. And so then the challenge is that the Senate is going to pretty much have to scrap that entire bill and start from scratch. And that's a challenge because to build a coalition that can pass the Senate, it needs to be conservative enough to appeal to people like Ted Cruz and Cotton and other really conservative senators in the Senate. But then it has to be moderate enough to get at least 50 votes, right? And 50 votes means you got to appeal to Olympia Snowe, Lisa Murkowski, Jeff Flake, Dean Heller, right? And so to appeal to the moderates and to also to appeal to the conservatives is a really difficult struggle. But even if the Senate is able to do that, then that bill that passes the Senate has to be passed by the House in identical form. If the House doesn't pass it in identical form, then it goes nowhere. And so I think that this is still a really, really tough road ahead. And now with opposition groups kind of drawing on, trying to say, hey, don't take away the Medicaid, don't cut Medicaid, don't cut health care. Then now the status quo is going to be easier to maintain. It's going to be harder to overcome that, which has been an interesting flip.
It has, and you know, when you talk about it having to go back to the House, that's where it's like, how do you imagine that whatever they're going to come up with? Because you made a good point about the Senate. The Senate is not like the House as right. far as political makeup right now. It's what is it 50-46, something like.
You got 50-51. There's 52. It's 52-48.
That's right.
Is what you got. And so the Senate can afford the Senate Republicans can afford two so-called defections, right? I hesitate to use the word defection, right? But two dissenting votes, and then Vice President Pence would be the tie-breaking vote. And so then as long as the Senate gets 50, then they'd be okay.
All right. And looks like we got a phone call coming in, but I was just trying to look at some more. Ratings and stats, and looking at the support for Obamacare, it is rising, and I think it's well over 50%. All right, let's go ahead and go to a break. It'll only be our second break of the hour. We talked about so much, and we got more to talk about, so we'll be right back.